Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
This is Tina Horn, and you're listening to episode 11, Side B of Why Are People Into That? My guest for episode 11 is Sarah Patterson, the executive director of the Persist Health Project. Persist is an organization that connects people in the sex trades with non-judgmental healthcare and social services, and they are fucking rad. And if you're in the New York City area and you do now or have ever worked in the sex industry, I urge you to head on over to persisthealthproject.org and get some more information. In part one, Sarah and I talked about why people are interested in being clients to various different kinds of sex workers. In this week, we delve into a more nuanced subject: why do people do sex work? Now, I want to make it abundantly clear that nobody, but nobody, is less interested than Sarah and myself in perpetuating the idea that the only reason people would do sex work is because they're quote-unquote into it, as the very title of my podcast suggests. Really, this episode is less about human desire for once and more about exploring the motivations for capitalizing on human sexual desire. Appropriately, I have a new piece on Vice.com reporting on whorephobia in major financial institutions, from Chase Bank closing down the accounts of porn stars to PayPal and WePay freezing the money that several out sex workers were raising for something other than sex work. It's called How the Financial Sector is Making Life Miserable for Sex Workers, and I originally wanted to call it How Can We Make It Rain? And I also wanted to just read you a little paragraph that my editor cut from the article to muse on before you listen to this episode. Although we have other aspects of our lives, like other jobs, hobbies, volunteer work, families, and communities, we are considered first and foremost to be whores. Even after we leave the industry, we have a scarlet W on our chests. We aren't being punished for being criminals. We are punished for using the power of our sexuality in public to support ourselves. All right, enough from my detached, abstract, sultry voice. Let's listen into the thrilling conclusion of Sarah and me trying to figure out why are people into sex work?
I mean, I have a theory that, like, for instance, I'll just give you one example. There's some literature out there that suggests that, much like queer folks, sex workers are more likely to smoke than other people.
That's interesting.
Now, smoking is directly related to anxiety management for a lot of people. Like, it's a coping mechanism. Right. And that's one of the reasons why a lot of queer people smoke, is because they're coping with fucking oppression all the time. Right? So, and it's like a way of, like, calming yourself down, like having something to do, like
having something fidgeting that you can control, just ritualistic and dependable.
Yeah.
Right.
And then, like, it's also a community thing because, like, you know, you're hanging out with other queers, they're smoking, you're like, it's a way of connecting to other people, and it's also a way of distancing yourself from people you don't want to be around. You need to leave a situation, you go outside and smoke. These are, like, ways in which people use smoking as a coping strategy. So there's some evidence that sex workers are also more likely to smoke than the average person. And
man, well, what else are you going to do when you're sitting around waiting for the phone to ring, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, there's also that, right? It's like, it's a time, it's a way to kill time. It's also like, you know, a way to distance yourself from your work. Like you get out of work, you want to relax, you want to chill, you smoke a cigarette, you have a cocktail, whatever. So I have a theory. I am not a psychologist, but I do have a theory that there are probably a lot of occupational, well, I hesitate to use the word occupational because, like I said, I don't think it's directly related to the job. I think it's related to the stigma and the anxiety, that people probably have long-term anxiety issues as a result of constantly dealing with stigma management. That stigma management relates to how people, that people get, because I think that you're like sort of, particularly if you're working at a place that has a bunch of video monitors and there's like baby monitors in the room, people are listening to you, you have to like walk a client out, you have to make sure you do the secret handshake on the like way out, and like there's all these like cloak of secrecy things that have to happen, like your heart rate is probably slightly above what it's supposed to be
work
all day at work. So, and if you're working a shift that could be like 6 to 8 hours, you could literally be spending 8 hours out of your day with like a low grade anxiety all the time.
Well, right. I mean, and the other side of that coin is that I think is seductive and attractive for people is that that can also manifest as an adrenaline rush, right? And it can also manifest as just a feeling of a clandestine feeling of doing something underground and dangerous and interesting and iconoclastic, and then also even the sort of the rush that you get as a performer or as an artist as well, of going through all of those little rituals. But yeah, it's a double-edged sword, to mix metaphors, because on one hand, like, adrenaline rush is great. On the other hand, that also can, depending on the circumstance, can also end up looking like anxiety, or can start out one way and end up being another way, or be one on one day and another on another day. And maybe something that starts out as feeling like an adrenaline rush all the time eventually becomes more having to do with anxiety, and then you have to have a coping mechanism like smoking or other addictions. And I guess going back to what we were initially saying, I would argue that the circumstances that produce that anxiety have to do with social stigma and the consciousness and circumstances that stigma forces sex workers into, rather than the actual literal in a vacuum exchange, like trade of sex for money.
And that's so much to manage at one time. And you're totally right. I mean, there could be a lot of good stuff in that bag too. Like just the idea that, you know, you're managing, what am I wearing? What does this client want? What am I doing today? How's management today? What's the situation where I'm working? Like, and then all of the privacy stuff and all of that going together, and also just like the performance of the actual sex work itself.
Yeah.
Is so many things happening at one time. And it totally, I mean, I think for folks it can definitely manifest as adrenaline, and then, like you said, the flip side of the coin and anxiety, like, which actually, and when I think about sex worker activists and like sex worker activists who have stopped working or are only working sporadically or things like that, it's interesting because I think that like sort of need to like have that anxiety pumping or adrenaline pumping like comes through in the activism. Like in terms of burnout, like I see people push themselves really, really, really hard for free, since 99.99% of sex worker activism is done for free. I see folks work really hard, and that's sort of transfer that like level of intensity over to something else as well. I mean, so maybe, of course, we haven't gotten into this, but, and this is always, it's so hard to say because the type of people who trade sex are so, so, so diverse and it's so difficult to generalize any of it. But whether it does attract folks who either who like the personality development aspects of it. I mean, I feel like I've definitely known sex workers who were like, I'm an outsider. Like, I want to do outsider things. Like, this fits my personality. I want to develop more around feeling like an outsider.
Word.
And then, but then also just folks who just get into it for many other different reasons. So that's not necessarily the reason why folks do it. But I do think that there is, you get tripped up in it because folks may go into it for that adrenaline, that feeling of adrenaline of like being a performer and like succeeding at something, making something happen in a sex work environment. But then I see people, I think that the stigma is such a trap because it's like, it gets internalized in ways that I think people don't always expect is going to happen. And it kind of like comes up in weird, it manifests itself in weird behaviors where I think folks don't even realize that it's like, it's internalized itself in that way. It's so insidious.
Yeah.
The anxiety is really insidious in terms of how it affects people's own internalized shame or their own feelings about their life. And it's sometimes difficult for us to see it right away as what it actually is.
Well, you know, you hit on something that's really interesting because, yes, there are obviously as many different motivations for wanting to be a sex worker as there are motivations to want to be a firefighter or an astronaut or a teacher or whatever. I think it's probably fair to say that every sex worker has their own experience of a personality shift or I don't want to say split because you know that is its own personality splits of their own thing and I don't want to necessarily suggest that it has anything to do with mental health, but there is, you do have to be somebody else at work in a very literal way. Most sex workers use an assumed name. Most sex workers behave in ways that are not necessarily reflective of them and perhaps even purport to have opinions that they don't actually have. They play a role. Mm-hmm. And some people, I think, relish the opportunity to develop that role for whatever reason, for artistic reasons, for coping mechanism reasons, for security reasons, for psychological compartmentalization reasons. But the truth of that actually is that in sex work, it's just more literal than how it is for everybody else. I mean, I think that I would ask like everyone listening to this program to stop and think about a job that they've had where they have felt like they had to be somebody that they're not. I mean, you know, first of all, you could be in a bad mood and you have to be in a good mood at most jobs. Especially ones that involve interacting with clients. You know, you're feeling low energy, you gotta figure out how to be high energy. You find someone disagreeable in some way, you gotta figure out how to make it seem like you find them like the hottest shit ever.
You only have to read Yelp reviews of restaurants to figure that one out.
Right.
You know, the server being nice or the server seeming interested in whatever you're talking about is an essential component of most people going out.
Right.
Having been a bartender for 5 years, it is not an essential component for me going out because I totally get it. But I do, but I, you know, when you go out to dinner with someone and they're like, oh, the server is so, it's like So nice.
Indulgent.
Yeah. Oh, she was so great that she did that. Or so great that he did that for us.
Right. I mean, it's part of what you're paying for instead of fucking staying at home and making yourself dinner.
Right.
Right. And I don't think that there's anything wrong with that. I like the idea of, you know, sometimes when I get off work at my retail job in Soho, it's really jarring for a second to, like, go out to dinner or, like, go do some shopping, like, in the area, because all of a sudden I'm like, the tables are turned, and, like, somebody's like, do you need anything? And I'm like, oh, gosh, I do. I have questions. You know? Like, all of a sudden I'm not the one with the answer. I'm the one with the question.
Yeah.
But anyway, I mean, I think that the point of this conversation, as it could be the point of many conversations, is that sex work is just like other work, just with sex. And sex is a big deal for people and makes things very charged. And people bring a lot of baggage and a lot of preconceived notions to things. And it just also, you know, ironically, sometimes sex makes people behave in a very juvenile manner, even though technically it's something for grown-ups to do and engage in and talk about and entertain one another in.
And there's something to be said for the fact that so many folks who are in the sex trade are women or gay men.
Right.
Who are already already feminized into social service professions and service professions as service providers.
That's a really fucking good point. Yeah.
And so I guess, you know, when you think about folks who are very anti-sex work, you think about, you know, the ways in which girls are socialized and the way that they're told to perform their gender is very much in line with service provision.
And taught to be accommodating and to know how to pamper and indulge people.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is definitely a part of our programming as female assigned at birth folks.
Yeah, don't set boundaries. Don't be a bitch. Don't have a hard line, you know.
Yeah. I want to also conclude by making sure that we have sort of at least touched on some of the important points also of the other side of this, which is why are people into that? Why are people into being sex workers? You know, I mean, the main difference, and I want to clarify, being that, you know, by into being sex workers, I don't necessarily mean why do people choose to be sex workers? Because they find it, like, sexually arousing, or they're, like, motivated by their, like, sexual desire, is a very different motivation from a client who is motivated by and large by their desire.
Right.
You know, but why are some people into being sex workers? I mean, you know, it's important to acknowledge that there are people who are coerced into sex work, and that is a really, really, really big issue. And there are also people who feel that they don't have much of a choice because of their social situation. And then there are also people who choose to do it for other reasons. And I guess I want to talk about what some of those reasons are.
I mean, for folks who trade sex for all kinds of different stuff that might not be money, mm-hmm. things for housing,
of course,
or drugs, or food, or other resources. I think it goes, honestly, it goes back to how prevalent, you pointed out, massage might be in Midtown, in New York City, in the middle of the day. It's that the sex trade can be accessed in many different ways at many different points, and it can look very different.
Yeah.
But folks know that this is the thing about about the sex trade is that you can step in and out of it if you are doing it by some semblance of choice. I think that there's a really difficult distinction between what a lot of folks in LGBT organizations refer to as survival sex and sex work, because, you know, one could argue that we're all, like, everybody who trades sex is trading sex to survive. So, you know, like, what the hell does survival mean? We're all surviving in one sense or another.
Right. I mean, I think that the, just to clarify, I mean, I think that the purpose of that distinction is that there are some people who, if they choose to stop doing sex work at any time, they have the social mobility to get a different source of income.
Right.
They have the relationship with their family of origin or chosen family or community to get their basic needs met of food and shelter, should they choose to leave the sex industry or stop doing sex work at any time. Right. And so for people who have the privilege of, who have those privileges, they're like trying to make a distinction between that and people who don't have those privileges for whatever reason.
Absolutely. My only bone to pick with that, and it actually took me like almost now almost a decade of being involved in sex worker activism in some capacity to see this, which is that sex work gets treated as though it's a positive term, and I don't necessarily think that work, like, just because we're defining something as labor, as like something to get something else, to me doesn't have a positive connotation, although I totally understand that folks do see it that way. That's sort of flip sides of the coin, right? Like sex, the sex work is work model is somehow seen as like a pro sex work model, when I don't necessarily think that, like, just defining it as labor doesn't, like, not all labor is awesome.
Right.
Or consensual.
Well, it's about agency and self-determination, right? It is so fucked up to, like, all, like living in a fucking capitalist society, as you do and I do, like, everything all the time, everywhere, is like work, 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 work. Like, you're defined by your work, you need to work, like, you are can only be patriotic if you work, you can only be, like, you can only actually, like, have.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Your love sanctioned by the state if you work, like, your fucking parents want you to work, who are you, what do you do for work, like, and then you're like, okay, cool, like, look, this opportunity to do something that I'm good at, like, I'm gonna work, and then fucking the same society is like, what the fuck are you doing, you're such a horrible, horrible whore, you don't deserve love, you don't deserve to do something else or work with children now, like, you don't deserve, you don't deserve fucking anything, like, what the fuck?
And I think you see it, I mean, I want to go back to your point, but that you were making before, talking about survival sex, but you see this in sex worker activism stuff too. I see people work themselves to the bone for free, for which, I mean, I know I keep emphasizing free, it's the capitalist in me who just keeps needing to point that out, but I see people working extremely, extremely hard and sacrificing self-care, sacrificing their own mental health in the pursuit of sex worker rights, and it is, I do think that, I mean, I am super, super guilty of this too, so I'm saying it just as much for myself as for anyone else, that when we think about healing and taking care of ourselves and recognizing that there's so much historical trauma around stepping into this work, that's also how it plays out for folks. Because just because folks stop working or exit the industry, as it were, doesn't mean that what you're talking about, that like work, it just gets transferred onto something else. It's just, you know,
absolutely.
Or, you know, folks, like, I mean, this is sort of the model of PERSIST, right? Is that folks move into social services or they move into healthcare, right? And they are in another service model providing services, just like a sex worker does, and they're still busting their ass. And yeah. So I think it is, it's very difficult. I think that the sex worker rights movement has a really hard time with community care and with self-care, because trauma is really real. And I'm sure there are other intersecting factors for why that happens. But to get back to what you were talking about in terms of agency and choosing the work, I mean, I also think of like, it's also just a situation where I think a lot about this in terms of housing too, because New York City, every week, it's like another thing with the housing. It's like, now there was an article recently out about how they're moving older adults from their house that they've had rent controlled for the last 40 years or whatever. They're trying to shift these folks into smaller, what they're calling economy apartments, or like, what do they call them? I think it might be economy apartments, but whatever. So they're trying to take...
Proto-coffins.
Proto-coffins, exactly. So they like... Because they want the housing. They want the housing that these folks are living in. They're trying to move
them into it. Sure, you can charge, like, you know, 5 artisanal something makers, like, you know, $1,200 each to, like, live in a place that is currently, like, being, you know, that has, like, been the home of, like, one person for 40 years. Exactly. Yeah, anyway.
Yeah, yeah. So, like... And pretty much, you get, like, in New York, you get, like, a weekly reminder that housing is hard to get. And when I think about my friends, and I think about, I keep mentioning articles, but there was also this wonderful piece in the New York Times, like, maybe 2 years ago now, about how people in New York are more likely to move in with each other more quickly because of housing than in many other cities.
Also, perhaps one of the reasons that a year feels like 3 years.
Exactly. We're all sped up. We move in at as fast a speed as possible in New York City.
That's why they call it a New York Minute.
Yeah. There you go. And in New York Minute, you could be living in your boo's house, and only a year has gone by, but it feels like 10. So, anyway.
And that's when you need a hand job.
And that's when
and
all the hand
loofah scrub down. Anyway.
But so I think about that. I think about the circumstances that people stay in order... Like, when I think about survival, I think about, like, the housing that folks stay in with an abusive partner because they need to live there.
Right.
Because they need to live somewhere. I think about, like, different relational structures that we deal with in a capitalist society where folks are under constrained options because of lack of employment options, because of trans identity, because of racism, you know, and all these different things that intersect to make it more difficult for folks to survive, you know, what folks refer to as institutional oppression. And so that stuff, I think, is very necessary to mention when we do talk about that stuff, because we write all this stuff onto that person's body in terms of like, oh, they're just trying to survive. They don't really want this. They're coerced. And then we don't look at necessarily at the coercive structures that are happening around that and the history of why that's happening. And so it's a tricky conversation to have, because I feel like Americans in particular are very, very interested in like, we're a culture that's so obsessed with suing people, right?
It's
like,
oh my God.
It's like somebody is at fault. It has to be a specific person. We have to find that specific person. And once that specific person is rooted out, the problem is solved.
And sort of the other thing that solves the problem is having money. So you've gone through something traumatic. You've, like, you know, literally lost a loved one. You've literally lost a limb. You've literally lost your house. But as long as you have, now you have $1 million, so... So everything's fine.
Right. So it's sort of like we have to figure out who the culprit is, because the culprit can't possibly be, like, the system. And so that's kind of, I mean, a person much smarter than me who works with youth who have been trafficked talks about, you know, she always says, like, well, we talk about traffickers, but we don't talk about the system as the trafficker, as the person. Like, this, the entire system is the thing that's doing it, not necessarily just this one individual or this one circumstance.
Right. Obviously, you know, it's easy enough to demonize somebody who traffics people, and, you know, those people should be, are culpable and need to be held accountable, et cetera, et cetera. And, but it's true, the circumstances that lead people to exploit others are the same circumstances that lead people to be exploited.
And it's just, I mean, if there's anything to get out of the conversation that we've just had about this, the motivations are complicated, and the reasons why people are in circumstances are complicated. And that has to do with the intersection of what a client or a John brings into a circumstance, and what the sex worker or the person who's trading sex brings into that circumstance, and then, like, the society at large and how it plays a role in that whole interaction. There's just, like, a lot of different things happening.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that sometimes, you know, something that doesn't get talked about a lot in sex worker activism, I think, is the fact that sometimes, for some people, a lot of the times, sex work can be really fun. Like, it can be really fucking fun. Yeah. Like, the outfits are fucking fabulous, the hours are fabulous, the cash in hand and the opportunity to not declare that cash whether or not you choose to can be really fucking fabulous. And, you know, the potential for camaraderie, the potential for women to work with other women, which is not something that happens outside of the sex industry as often as it happens in the sex industry.
In one of the highest paying professions for women in the United States.
Right. And the oldest, I hear. Older than the rumor. It is older than the United States, I'm told.
So they say.
You know, I think some people find it an opportunity for a lot of soul searching, a lot of body searching, and by that I mean, you know, the opportunity to put your body in really extreme situations in circumstances that for many sex workers are often actually very structured and emotionally and physically safe, you know, in the same way that an athlete or even, you know, a dancer or a performance artist or actor will put themselves in extreme situations for the very opportunity to test their body, to test their psychological endurance, to test their mettle and their ability to develop their craft and push themselves with something that they may consider to be, I think many sex workers that I have talked to consider sex work to be a craft.
Mm.
And, you know, it's also, like, totally fucking cool and underground and outsider thing to do. Like, that's real.
Yeah,
like, that's a reason. That's a reason to do it. It's part of certain kinds of styles. It's part of certain kinds of cultures. It can feel really good to have somebody to have you know, people day in day out call you a goddess and to tell you that you're beautiful, to bring you money specifically because you are beautiful. And, you know, that's, I'm not trying to in any way over idealize sex work, but, because there are shadow sides to each and every one of these examples. But I think that those are also some of the motivations that, that I have heard from people for doing that work. I think sometimes also people are like, I'm sexually liberated or sexually curious or interested in sexual experimentation, and now I get to do it and get paid.
Yeah.
You know, and have lots of different kinds of experiences with other humans and meet people. And, you know, I mean, you kind of have to be a people person to be successful in sex work.
There's also just examples of places where people are deemed unfit or not fit enough within capitalism where sex work is a good option for them, like folks who have limited mobility, who can do webcam work, things like that. Like, those are ways in which, right? Like, capitalism tells you, like, if you can't stand on your fucking feet for 8 hours, then you're worthless somehow. I mean, I can't stand on my feet for 8 hours without getting really irritable. So,
I have a friend.
I can only imagine.
I have a friend who is diagnosed with Tourette's, and it makes it actually quite difficult for him to get and maintain work. And so sex work actually is an environment in which he is able to either, like, redirect his tics or his tics just, like, don't matter.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, also, perhaps as a final point, like, I think that it's actually quite interesting how many, like, you were talking about, like, many different kinds of bodies. You know, I think that in sex work there are more opportunities to be validated for a lot of different kinds of sexy bodies and identities than there are in, like, mainstream culture, mainstream society, even conventional dating and interaction with, you know, like, places where we talk about, like, what is and is not attractive, like, right. online dating or dating culture or fucking the you know, institution of marriage or whatever. You know, I think that, like, people of size, trans people, you know, people who just don't, I don't know, there's lots of different, there's somebody who is interested in hiring all different kinds of people. Not to say that people should look to, like, their clients for their self-esteem or their validation, but I think that it can actually be kind of amazing to see. I guess what I'm trying to say is that actual human desire is much more varied than conventional ideas of beauty and sexiness and attractiveness would have you believe, because it's much easier to be reductive when you want to sell things, which is what all of that ideology is about. Mm-hmm. And so in sex work, I think that there's a broader opportunity to see all kinds of different things that people actually are interested in, and that the truth of that is sort of laid bare.
Yeah. Well, you have a pink streak in your hair, and I used to have a pink streak in my hair, and I was bartending at the time at a sort of schmancy place, and I got it and didn't even think about, I didn't even think that it would have any impact on my, I just was like, oh, I dye my hair all kinds of different colors, I'll just dye it pink. And then, like, immediately the first day I came in, the manager was like, no.
Wow.
Like, fix your hair. Not gonna work. And I hadn't really considered my body as a commodity within bartending before. Like, I didn't work at a bar where I had to really wear anything sexy. It was a pretty, like, formulaic outfit. It was, like, a black top and a black pair of pants. I didn't really think, like, the way I looked had any impact on my job.
Wait, you mean that bodies are policed in all forms of labor, not just sex work? Is that what you're
That is kind of what I'm getting at.
Interesting.
It was, I mean, and of course, like, I mean, I had issues with, like, facial piercings and stuff like that at jobs like that. That's definitely something that comes up as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it was something along the lines of, I've definitely had a lot of friends who have also worked in bartending and serving say to me that they, who have also been sex workers, and say to me things like, you know, I felt more exploited. I have a friend, a close friend, who's a sous chef, used to be a sous chef, who now works in policy work. And she says to me, like, I felt more exploited as a sous chef than I ever felt doing sex work. And it's just definitely an experience that, in terms of labor rights and, like, what's really going on, there's just an opportunity to look at all kinds of different places where this stuff comes up, so.
Yeah, no, I mean, in many cases, an interaction between a sex work provider and a sex work consumer, there is an opportunity or even a sort of, like, expected period of negotiation of boundaries and desires, and it would be awesome if that actually happened more in the rest of the world.
Yeah.
But also, because that structure is there, people have more of a are more expected to put their to sort of consensually agree, like two humans consensually agreeing on what the power exchange is going to be and what it's going to look like. And that can be really refreshing, even if, like, for example, like with a BDSM provider, if that power exchange literally looks like the client, like, dominating the provider who is being, you know, sexually submissive or in some sort of, like, you know, DS or, like, sadomasochistic way being submissive, you know, like, literally crawling around on the floor or being spanked or something. literally crawling around on the floor, being spanked or being called a slut or whatever, in a scene that is explicitly negotiated, feels a lot more consensual and satisfying than, you know, being, you know, power tripped by customers in retail or by your like micromanaging shitty boss. Yeah. So
that's cool. A whole another discussion.
That certainly is. And we have been talking for an hour and 40 minutes. And speaking of work, I have to go to work. And where can people find out more about Persist now that they know what an awesome organization it is?
Cool. So we are on Twitter under Persist Health and Facebook under Persist Health Project. And the website is persisthealthproject.org.
Can you spell that?
Sure. PERSIST.
Cool.
Healthproject.org.
Fantastic. Well, it's an absolute pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you so much.
I love you.
I love you too.
Yay!
Like I mentioned last episode, our wonderful sponsors, Smitten Kitten, are one of the most sex worker friendly organizations out there. So whether you're on or off the clock, smittenkittenonline.com is the place to visit for all of your sex toy, book, porno, and safer sex supplies. Thanks for downloading or streaming episode 11. You can listen to every episode of Why Are People Into That for free on our fancy website, whyarepeopleintothat.com. And even if you're not into squirting or high heels or prostate pleasure, I promise you'll still be stimulated and entertained by every episode. You can also subscribe on iTunes, and if you can just take a few seconds to rate us on iTunes by clicking the little star or writing a review so that more people can share in the Why Are People Into That love, it really helps make this podcast last. You can also like us on Facebook and follow us on at Into That Podcast, and you can follow me at Tina Horn's Ass. I guess it's redundant to say at twice. I don't really understand Twitter. I hope you do. Next month, my guest is Nayland, talking about chastity. Why are people into chastity? And he was the first guest ever to engage in the episode subject while we talked about it. Intrigued? Well, you'll just have to wait till next month to find out what in the hell I'm talking about. So see you then.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.